Hey, I'm Ben Stiller.
I'm Adam Scott.
And we make a TV show called Severance. On January 17th, Severance is back for season 2 on Apple TV+, and we can't wait for you guys to see it.
And before the premiere, Ben and I are going to be binging season 1 and putting out daily recap podcasts.
Yep. Each weekday beginning January 7th, we'll be dropping an episode featuring exclusive behind-the-scenes tidbits and brilliant insights from our cast and crew and us.
Patricia Arquette, Britt Lauer, Zach Cherry, John Turturro, the list goes on.
All your favorite Lumen employees, their friends, families, enemies, in your feed every single weekday.
And here's the best part. After that, we're going to keep going. Tune in weekly as we recap every episode of season 2. The podcast drops on the same day the episode comes out.
It's the Severance Podcast with Ben and Adam.
On Apple Podcasts, the Odyssey app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to The Connection, a weekly radio program where we share our experiences and expertise with stories of caring, courage, and change right here in Connecticut. Listen to learn about needed resources to improve your well-being and transform your life. Now, here are the hosts of The Connection, Lisa DeMattis-Lepore and Anne Baldwin.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this week's program. I'm pleased to once again be joined by my co-host for the program, Lisa DeMattis-Lepore, also the Chief Executive Officer of The Connection. And we've also got with us in studio today Patrick Fallon. He's the Director of Community Justice Services for The Connection. And we were really lucky. We lucked out. We even got a state representative to take a couple of moments to join us for this program. We've got State Representative Brandon McGee here, and he is a Democrat who represents Windsor and also Hartford. So, Representative, first of all, welcome to the program. We want to talk to you because, you know, having Patrick on this program, we're talking about community justice services that are offered by The Connection. And Patrick, I'm going to let you take over this interview because you've been working with a representative and you're really impressed by the approach that he takes to remediation, if you will, of people's lives.
Correct. Thank you for your time, sir. Could you talk a little bit about some of the work you've done with the Second Chance Act?
Certainly. And before I even dive into responding to your question, I really appreciate the opportunity to be on the show to talk a little bit about the work that's already being done statewide here in Connecticut. And I'm just afforded the opportunity, number one, to be a part of the conversation, but I think, two, sharing my perspective, having been in a household whose parent, my father, experienced a lot of time behind bars, and so I understand. But Patrick, to answer your question, the state of Connecticut has done a lot of work to, number one, bring the conversation of reentry, providing individuals with a second opportunity as they reenter into our various communities and neighborhoods. But focusing a bit more on the barriers that one faces when they do enter the community. My thesis, my master's, was basically on this very topic. You know, what types of services, what types of legislation is helping to support individuals that are entering back into community? We can talk about many different barriers, but for me, I could remember, like it was yesterday, my father coming home, sitting at the dining room table with my siblings and my mother, and really struggling, you know, trying to figure out how is he going to, number one, support himself, but support his family. He could not find employment.
You know, that's one of the things that, you know, The Connection has been, you know, forward thinking in this. And as we sit here and listen to the representative's story, real life story about his father, what comes to mind and how have you kind of molded your programs around those kinds of needs? We talked about stereotypes before the show started. It's all part of the puzzle, right?
Right. I think that clearly we find also, too, that all of the folks that, you know, that we interact with, you know, this topic really is their passion for a variety of reasons, whether it touched them personally or through a family member. And I think that really speaks to the reason why I think that this program is so important, because I'm sure our listeners are listening and feeling in some way they can relate to what the representative is telling us today. But also, the, you know, Connecticut, just to echo what was just said, Connecticut has been extremely forward thinking with regard to, you know, safety and community justice, et cetera. And so our programs are continually growing and changing due to the rapid needs in Connecticut.
All right. Well, if you're just tuning in, we're speaking with State Representative Brandon McGee, and we should mention that you're serving your third term. Congratulations, I think.
Congrats.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And you represent parts of Windsor and Hartford. You're also the vice chair of Finance, Revenue, and Bonding Committees. You're also a member of the APROPS, Education and Human Services Committee. So, you know, let me ask you one of the tough questions that's being asked right now, if I can, Representative McGee, and that is, you know, dollars are short. A lot of agencies like The Connection, like other social service agencies, like, you know, the Department of Mental Health and Addiction Services, you know, it's cut to the bone. And so how much of a voice do you have up there, and what is it that you're pleading for? What is it that you want to see happen for people in our community, whether they're suffering from addiction, homelessness, incarceration?
Yeah, that's a great question. Number one, we all know, and you all have read in the paper or you've received notices, if you are a leader of any nonprofit or state agency, of cutbacks and layoffs and et cetera. One of the things among many, I am advocating for our services that are directly connected to the very programs that you just outlined. But the reality that we face here in the state of Connecticut is that we have not identified new streams of revenue to support many of these programs.
Agreed.
So I think what we have to do is Connecticut, you know, we have to take a look at ourselves. We got to figure out how to be a bit more innovative. We have to be a bit more creative, become a bit more business friendly. But also, in addition to that, we have to figure out how to do some things differently. And, you know, for many years, we've been spending and spending and spending. And again, not thinking about years down the line, which we're faced with today. How are we going to pay for the very services that mean a lot to many of our districts? So, you know, streamlining, consolidating, or, hey, program, can you look at other ways in which, you know, by which you can, you know, take care of your budgets and programs and services? So there's not necessarily one answer to all of the questions that are being asked on how do we save many of these programs. But for me, that's my response.
I mean,
but then if I had to scale back, I have to take care of my district and just making sure people there are taken care of. But it's tough.
I would also like to say that the state of Connecticut cannot afford the price tag of mass incarceration anymore. The services we provide at a much lower rate than it costs to keep people incarcerated.
Right.
So I think it's very important that the people of Connecticut understand that it's very expensive to continue to incarcerate low-risk offenders.
Can I just add something? One of the things that was really special about our roundtable discussion on reentry is that we had not only formerly incarcerated at the table, but we had business owners,
Absolutely.
We had the nonprofit sector, we had the foundation, Hartford Foundation for Public Giving, and other private investors that are interested in this very topic that we're talking about. And so there's no real cookie-cutter approach to helping one reenter the community.
Right.
And so we have to be open-minded about this and think creatively on how we're going to fund many of these great programs and social services that are being provided. So that's still a part of the conversation, and I think that, you know, everything that you just said, Patrick, is true.
Yeah. Well, and Representative, I want to thank you for being on the program. We're going to continue this conversation. We'd love to have you back again. And I think one of the big steps in the right direction is having somebody like Senator McGee, who is...
I got a promotion.
Yeah. You just got a personal endorsement. You're kind of cute,
there
too,
you
if
go.
I do say something.
I love it. So what I'll do is, don't hang me up. I'll put myself on mute, and I'd love to hear the remaining of the conversation.
Okay.
Well, thank you.
Before we do that, I just want to thank you on behalf of the Connection for your support of our programs and all the great work that you're doing in our state to, you know, really work around this issue. And as you know, but I'm going to just reiterate to you that we're really grateful and we're really open to further conversations to think out of the box, because we want to be part of the solution and not part of the problem. So thank you so much. I applaud your efforts.
So, you know, what we just heard from the representative is someone up there with a real perspective.
Right.
And it's like anything else. You know, as a person myself in recovery, you know, my kids have a different perspective on people in recovery because they've lived with it.
Right.
You know, just like, you know, Representative McGee, his father, you know, incarcerated, sitting at the kitchen table, which he's, mm-hmm. you know, describes. And I can see that.
Can't you just hear the, I could just hear the passion in his voice about how dedicated he is to this work and why it hits home for him. And I think that's really huge. And clearly he's, you know, doing the best that he can, and he wants to think out of the box. And I do agree with everything that he pointed out about moving forward. And, you know, it isn't cookie cutter. We need mm-hmm. to be creative in Connecticut and come together and sit at the table and realize that we're all a piece of this puzzle, and we need to bring our resources to further serve this population.
I think it's very important that we get together and address some of the stigmas and misinformation that's attached to reentry. The majority of the people that are incarcerated in our state are very low risk. You take a lot of people, you put them in a small area with very little opportunity. What we create is an atmosphere of hopelessness. And, you know, we incarcerate these people and we send them right back to these areas. There's very small areas of Connecticut where a majority of inmates who are incarcerated right now come from. And I also think we need to reinvest in those communities and create opportunities for those people.
Well, isn't it just like if you identify a certain neighborhood where everybody's getting breast cancer?
Right.
Look at the research and look at the energy that goes into figuring out why is that happening? Why is everybody getting sick?
Mm-hmm.
Well, wouldn't you think you'd do the same thing if you had a community like that, which you've already said, Patrick, has been identified.
Right.
What's going on there? What can be changed? What kind of services do they need?
Well,
do they need jobs? What are they, housing? What is it?
Well, I, in my opinion, the problem is that in these areas, people are actually disenfranchised, which is one of the things mass incarceration does. It disenfranchises people from the whole political fight. So a lot of constituents, if you don't have a personal investment in something like this, it's not in your political interest to do anything other than say, lock them up, you know, they break the law, they deserve to be in jail. We do know what the problem is. There is a stigma. You know, when somebody's diagnosed with breast cancer, we find a cluster of breast cancer people. As a society, we want to help them.
Right.
When you're talking about formerly incarcerated or incarcerated people, we don't have that same empathy and compassion.
Absolutely not. So the Connection, Lisa, has a program called REACH, Reentry Assisted Community mm-hmm. Housing, and I'll have you both speak to that. And I, you know, I'm curious how long this has been going on. And I got to tell you, as a former news reporter, one of the stories that it seemed to always be recurring was not in my backyard. People would want to put these supportive housing programs and services into neighborhoods, which is where people deserve to live. But, you know, there'd always be an outcry, a protest.
Right.
So talk a little bit about your REACH program. And I know I'm throwing a lot of stuff at you, but, you know, what has the how have communities, or have they, you know, welcomed this at all since my old days of news reporting when it was protest after protest?
Right. Well, to be frank, a lot of the neighborhoods where we house these people, what REACH is it's a scattered housing program throughout the state of Connecticut. We what we do is we rent 2-bedroom apartments from landlords, and we house two people coming out of incarceration. For the most part, the people in the neighborhood do not know the difference between their neighbor who hasn't been incarcerated and these people. That's a good way to look at it.
Mm-hmm.
They do not know. The REACH program is very unique in the fact that we actually give people coming out of the system a lot of autonomy, as if they are free in society. They have to cook, they have to fend for themselves, they have to wash clothes. Those are really big things that we
take for
granted.
Wait a minute, I'm gonna stop you there. You said they have to cook, they have to do this, they have to do that. They don't have to. What it is to me is they're just productive members of society.
Exactly.
Right? So it's not that they have to. They have the opportunity to live like a normal resident, right?
Exactly.
They have jobs. They have responsibilities. They have skills. It's not like these people were just plopped into a jail cell without life skills before they got there, right?
Right.
Well,
right.
Some of them, you'd be amazed. Some of them were.
Okay.
I think one of the most overused terms in this field is rehabilitation. I stress not to use that term with employees, because when we say rehabilitation, what we're doing is assuming that people have these skills, and sometimes we start somewhere where they aren't ready to be.
I see. You still got to meet them where they're at.
Meet them where they're at.
So, Lisa, what do you think about that? And as the CEO of The Connection, is that where you focus? We talk about meeting people where they're at.
Absolutely.
Because everybody's different. And I love what the representative said, is that, and you repeated it, it's not a cookie-cutter approach.
Right.
Everybody's individual, and so shouldn't their care be?
Their care has to be individualized. That's really key. You know, everyone's at a different place. They've had different, while there may be similar experiences, there are also many differences. And the key is really getting to know that client that we're dealing with, and to meet them where they are, and to take the treatment from there, and to build realistic expectations and goals, because not everybody's the same. I think the other thing too is that one thing that happens is, you know, you may see someone who's, you know, 45 or 55 or whatever the age is, and so, you know, immediately you may assume, oh, this person's at a specific age, therefore their maturity level somewhere, that, you know, they need to be doing X, Y, and Z. And I think, you know, we bring staff on that understand that, you know, you can't judge a book by its cover, and you really need to start, you know, it's like peeling an onion. You find out what's really going on, and you start working on the issues to assist the person to move forward. And we've always been astonished by the clients and many folks that have gone through our doors, really how far they've progressed, you know, since coming into treatment, and that they stay in contact with us and, you know, in the future program, you know, and we're, you know, I know we're going to be bringing on clients that have graduated from our program, and you'd just be astonished to hear the success, really.
Mm-hmm. So if you're just tuning in, we're speaking with Patrick Fallon. He's the director of the Community Justice Services Program. And of course, we've got Lisa DeMattis-Lepore, who's with me every week on this program. And we appreciate you being along listening. So let's talk a little bit, Patrick, because you've been in this line of work, let's call it, for several years.
Correct.
How has it changed? And share some of the, you know, we can sit here and talk about how these programs work and how they work, but tell me some stories of some individuals, obviously without, you know, breaking mm-hmm. their confidentiality, but what have you seen? What is it that keeps you, you know, getting out of bed every morning and heading into the office?
Well, there's nothing better than being in the grocery store or being in the mall or in a parking lot and somebody walking up to you and saying, hey, do you remember me? And you're like, of course I remember you. And they're married and they're working and they're saving money, or they bought a house, and they thank you for the work that that you've done with them. That's what gets me up every morning and sort of keeps me doing this work.
I love that story. It's interesting to say that, because I had that same experience this week where I was at a community client award dinner, and a former client of mine over 25 years ago, I would never have recognized him, you know, came up to me and reintroduced himself. And of course, then it all started flowing back. And he said, and this isn't why, you know, why we do the work, obviously, but he said, you were such an important part of my life, you know, 27 years ago, and you have no idea really, you know, what was going on and, you know, what changes I made since then. And he's had his struggles, you know, since, and he was actually in one of our programs. But again, I think that, you know, the point is that it's with any circumstance that you have, Anne, those people that are there for you during your, you know, time
darkest
of need,
days.
They
mm-hmm.
do. They you know, it can be the smallest little thing, but you remember those.
Not to that person.
Not to that person, though.
Yeah. I mean, it even goes down to even people in the, you know, again, you know, I'm not going to get into an overly personal story, but, you know, going through a health crisis with a family member, it was that person that parked my car because mm-hmm. I was so frustrated and upset about what was happening, that took the car and just made that moment of my life easier. Mm-hmm. And so it's all those people. It's remembering what it's like, viewing from you know, the consumer's point, when you're needing a service, viewing it through those eyes, what it's really like. And you know what, Patrick, can you tell a quick, just a quick story to our listeners about that, the project that happened in your service area where we had the clients walking around with cameras?
Oh yeah, that was actually pretty neat. What we did was we had our clients go out in the community where they were from, and we gave them cameras, video cameras, and they could take still pictures. And they took pictures of the environment where they came from and where they're going. And we had it all pieced together and put sound to it. And it was a story about their life. And, you know, they took so much pride in this. And you could see what it did was, as they were telling this story, you could see with a lot of these guys that you would actually see this spark of hope.
Right.
You know, and I see that as my job and the people I work with. Our job is to instill hope in people, because if people are hopeless, they're not going to put the effort, you know, forth.
Absolutely. Well, you know, we talked a little bit about Reach Up, which is the Reentry Assisted Community Housing Program. So that was a one-year federally funded project, and to collect the data, right?
So we have the Reach Up program, okay, which is a scattered housing site.
Right.
In 2014, we applied for a grant with the Bureau of Justice Assistance. It was adult mentoring for people reentering into society. Now, I want to preface this by saying that peer services, like self-help, where people help each other, is very popular in recovery from substance abuse. It's very popular in mental health. But when you talk about the criminal justice field, because there's that stigma, mm-hmm, you know, I don't want to put two criminals together because they're going to commit a crime.
Which is,
you
so know, wrong. It's it, like saying, it I don't want to put two drunks together because they're going to go drinking.
What
we better get out of the same room.
when we were awarded this grant, we brought peers in to go in, and it was part of a study. We had a control group who didn't receive the peer mentoring services, and we had a group that received the mentoring services. And what the mentors do is they come in and they've been where these men are. So they instill hope automatically because they've managed to navigate a lot of barriers that these,
right,
these gentlemen are currently going through.
So our listeners can't, mm-hmm, see this graph that I have in front of,
right,
me. But, you know, like anything, when you receive federal funding, you have to keep track of your successes, mm-hmm, and or your failures, and that's what you've done. And this looks like nothing but success to me.
Right.
So explain to our listeners what the outcomes of what's really called, you know, the peer-to-peer, mm-hmm, you know, the mentored support.
So again, I need to say we're in the beginning stages of paring down the data. But what we see so far is very promising. There's a 30% difference in success for people who receive the peer-related services when you compare it against the people who did not receive the services. That is a tremendous
success. It's really huge.
Well, it's huge, Lisa. But, you know, let me ask you this, because we just talked to the representative about, you know, funding issues. And Patrick indicated, well, we're just in kind of the infancy of this program. Well, a lot of agencies and a lot of your programs, you know, they're contingent on continued funding for continued success. I mean, how do you deal with that when you see that these things are working and, you know, at any time, you know, you could get, you know, one of your pillars knocked out from under you?
Oh, that's just like my worst nightmare. That's why I'm up at 2 o'clock in the morning, I guess. one of the reasons. I think that we believe that we are, you know, a visionary organization. We have come up with some pretty creative ways to keep our programs afloat. And one thing that I have to say is that I'm really proud of is that we do have the data and research that's connected to our programs. We're publishing articles right now about it. And, you know, we're going to be getting the word out there. And, you know, we're hoping, I mean, we're working, you know, very quickly in talking to folks in the community and folks up at the legislative office building about how we can be part of the solution and showing them that numbers are working, we're saving money. I mean, there comes a point where, you know, some services, if we stop them, they're going to be devastating to our state, period.
And it's going to cost the state more money.
Triple.
You know, that's the thing that people don't get. You know, it sounds like, well, you should be asking yourself, why are we spending all this money to incarcerate and reincarcerate people, where if they got the proper tools when they got out the first time or when they were even in there, we wouldn't have half of this problem.
And that's why, you know, I think that, you know, we've been collecting data for so long, and I think we've really been ahead of the curve with regard to, you know, this aside work that we do with our numbers. And, you know, they really tell a story, and we've been able to, you know, expand our programs and do different things because of exactly that. And we're going to continue to do it because we know that the services work, and we know that we're, you know, people are not reoffending, and the recidivism rate, as Patrick said, is extremely low. We want to educate people more and let them understand why these services are important. And, you know, you can't, the data doesn't lie. I could sit here and tell you how wonderful the connection is and how great our programs are, and et cetera. But the reality is, we've got the data. We've got the numbers. We're doing this because it is working. So when I tell you that, it's not because I'm, you know, here promoting an agency or a program. It's because we have this data on all of our programs, and we need to get this word out more because we are saving the state money. Period.
Right.
And to continue to throw people, you know, get them incarcerated and not have programs, we're continuing generational cycles of abuse. Mm-hmm. We're increasing crime if we don't have these programs. We're costing the state triple the amount of money, and it's only going to get worse. So, you know, I mean, we feel like we need to continue moving forward.
We do it cheaper, and we have better outcomes.
Well, you know, and that's just it.
That's the bottom line.
Right. And, you know, if Lisa sounds like she's fired up, she is. Mm-hmm. And so aren't you, Patrick, because you see the reality. You know, it's easy to say slash this, slash that. You know, we got to quit throwing money at this. And there's a lot of other things that don't have those measured outcomes that you're talking about, Lisa, that perhaps should be looked at and not services like this. Because you know what? Crime isn't going to go away.
No.
Substance abuse isn't going to go away. Homelessness isn't going to go.
It's
going to get worse.
When we cut
services like this, the state is being penny wise and dollar foolish. I mean, the price tag on the back end when you cut services like this is humongous to the taxpayer. Programs like this take people who cost taxpayers money and turn them into taxpaying citizens.
Don't get me started, Patrick. Thank goodness we're at the end of this program.
I know. Now I'm all fired up.
That's right. Well, we'll stay fired up, all right?
Okay, let's do that.
All right. Well, I want to thank, again, State Representative Brandon McKee for being on the program. Patrick Fallon, it was great having you in studio.
Thank you.
Of course, Lisa, it's always nice seeing your smiling and sometimes passionate face. And thank you, our listeners, for tuning in to this edition of The Connection right here on WTIC News Talk 1080.